Okay, I'm looking at my clock here. It says 9:01, so that's time to start. It's been a while since I've been doing this, but a lot happened in the intermediate time. I'm glad to be back, though. We have a session of 6 classes. I just look at the names. I think you've all been with me, so you all know how to use the device here. We will continue what we were doing last semester, dealing with Rav Zevin. Then we're going to move on to Rav Yitzchak Kanan Spector. If you're asking me realistically, we will finish the whole semester. We'll be with those two. Although it did advertise Rav Avadi Yosef the early years. That's because I did want to fill in. I did Rav Avadi Yosef, a very, very important figure in our day, at the very beginning of this series, some 5-6 years ago. But at the time, I didn't follow the model I'm doing now, the biography. So with Rav Avadi, I just spoke about some of his ideas and significance. So I want to fill in with his biography. And then, I don't know, I think maybe go on to the Ben Ish Chai. I have a lot of ideas. But without any further ado, let me welcome you all to another semester. Let me make an announcement quickly before we start that... Because of the good success we've had the last couple of years, Torah in Motion and myself will again be having trips, God willing, the coming summer, in the beginning of July, end of June, beginning of July, to Central Europe again, and Italy in August, early August. If anyone is interested, you can let me know. Look for Torah in Motion on the website. The info should be up any day now. I had thought that I'd be able to do a trip to Spain this summer, with this new book I'm trying to complete, it's actually pretty much done. I didn't have time, although I am going to Spain in December, and that will be the next trip we have planned. Other than that, I have nothing new to say. Let us start. We're picking up with Rav Zevin, where we left off. If you haven't heard it, I invite everyone to listen to the previous classes. Obviously, those of you who are with us, you'll get the classes, if you missed them, sent to you. But before we start, it's been 6 months, so I have a number of questions and comments, but as is my practice, let me just respond to two things. The first one, on your screen here, this goes back already months, although we stopped teaching 6 months ago, but I had mentioned that I had a book. When my library had the book, University, here it is, Lithuanian Jewish Culture by David Katz, a big, thick book. And it's because I had mentioned that the reason I brought this up is because I had said that Baranovich was a Hasidic yeshiva, and someone, he's not here now, challenged that assertion, and I said that although Rabbi Hanan was not Hasidic, my understanding is that most of the Bachrim there were Hasidic, and that it had a Hasidic environment in the yeshiva. I know, for example, or I was told by someone who went there, that on Nittel they did not study Torah, which would not be the case. That is Christmas Eve. That would not be the case in a Lithuanian yeshiva. And I mentioned that this is also found in David Katz's book, and here is what I was referring to. You have a list. He divides them into Misnagdic, Hasidic, Musar Yeshiva, so you see you have Slobodka, Kelm, you have others that are Musar. You have some that he transition yeshivas, that is those yeshivas like between, I'm not sure why Lida has red on it also, that doesn't seem to make any sense, unless he means there's a lot of Hasidim there, which I don't think is the case at all. But this is the chart. I can't say how accurate the chart is, but at least what I said about Baranovich, it supports. Let me... Yeah, he has Radin as a Misnagid yeshiva. Let's see. Obviously, Navardic would be a Musar yeshiva. I'm not sure. I'm actually going to email him and ask him... Unless he means the transition, no, he has Lida as transition, not Hasidic. I'm not sure what the transition would be, though. So I am going to email him and ask him, unless anyone has any idea what he means by transition here. There's Navardic over there, right below Lida. He goes up underneath Slobodka, has the Kolo HaKrushim, which we will speak about the Ritz Al-Hanan, and that's true. It goes from Misnagdik into Musar. right to the left, at the top here, you have Knesset Yisrael, Musar, and Knesset Beis Yitzchak, which isn't Musar. Okay, things we'll speak about. Let me just make a note to find out what the story is. Lida is, that's the first thing I wanted to show you. It's a very nice book. The second thing I want to mention is as follows. Just one more thing, actually, because I want to get right to Rav Zevin. I quoted by memory what Nassim Kamenetsky said, that that Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen, who we ended last semester, was regarded by his father as one of the great Gedolim of his day. I mentioned that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg thought that he was the leading sage. It's actually, for those who want to check, it's 739 in Making of Gadol, that his father claimed that Meir Simcha of David Friedman of Karlin, the Rugged Shover of Chaim Soloveitchik, were the top four rabbis of their day. And on other occasions, he actually said that Rav Chaim and Rav David Karliner were the top, and Rav Meir Simcha and the Rugged Shover the second. Okay, the other things I want to show you, I want to show you some interesting things, but I'll wait till next class. Let's get right in it with pick up where we're with Rav Zevin. And if you recall, or maybe you won't recall, it's been a while, one of the last things I mentioned was we were speaking about the Rayatz, the Lubavitch Rebbe Rayatz, and I said that I seem to recall, well, I didn't say I seem to recall, I said that I'm certain, or pretty certain, that he was sentenced to death when he went to prison. And I checked it, and lo and behold, the reports are that he was, in 1927, sentenced to death. That's the facts you'll get if you look at any history book. However, there is a scholar, a young Hasidic scholar, who's really works with academic stuff as well. His name is Yechiel Goldhaber. I don't know if anyone has heard of him. He's in Muncie right now. Gave a shiur last night. He's here for a week and a half. He's really done unbelievable work. I met with him over the summer when he was in Williamsburg, and he tells me that he has investigated. He's not a Chabadnik. He's a different type of chassid, a Stolener, Karlin Stolen. He told me that he investigated this in detail, and he thinks that this is a legend created by Chabad. He says that none of the Jewish newspapers of the time mention anything about the Lubavitch Rebbe being sentenced to death. Now, I can't, and none of the rabbinic writers. All they do is mention him being sent to prison, or exile. It wasn't prison, it was sort of like an exile. And none of them mention anything about being sentenced to death. So that's what he says. He's usually very reliable. He actually has a little booklet coming out about the Titanic in halachic literature, if anyone is interested in that. He also told me, we spoke about in the past, about this forged archive of letters of the Baal Shem Tov called the Charson Archive. I spoke about this with the Rayatz, and Goldhaber says that he believes that the Rayatz was involved in forging this Cherson archive. If you remember, I told you that the Rayatz published a book on the Tzemach Tzedek and the Haskalah, which is full of falsifications, and I thought that maybe the Rayatz was just repeating things that he heard, Baba Maisa's legends. Goldhaber believes that the Rayatz intentionally created a false history for the reasons that we speculated on, that this would give his Hasidim, a better history than the one they had, that, not that their history was bad, but a history more in line with the ideals that the Rayatz was trying to put forth. Because there's no question, I told you the story about when I was in Venice, that I was with this real Kanoi from B'nai B'rak, and I mentioned that there's a lot of things that aren't true, and he's an expert in this also. I said there's a lot of things that aren't true in the Rayatz's history, and he said a lot of things that aren't true. Find me one thing that is true. So there you get the sense of what I'm talking about. Okay, we ended last class, and the last thing we were talking about, and we're going to get to some important information which has been sent to me by David Eisen in a few minutes. He's not listening to us now, but he often listens to us live from Israel. We ended by talking about Rav Zevin's view of the state of Israel. And I want to begin by citing what Rav Zevin's grandfather has to say. I mean, Rav Zevin's grandson has to say about his grandfather's view of the state of Israel. I mentioned that he was a big Zionist, but it's a type of Zionist. He says that this is on page 31 of his essay at the beginning of the new edition of Ishim B'Shitot. He says that my grandfather's view on the state was clear. He used to say often that, this is after saying that he's a big Zionist, he used to say that those who say that this is the Eschalt of the Geula, he says some say that this is the Eschalt of the Geula, some say that it's not, there's nothing to do with the Geula. Saba Haya Omer, my grandfather used to say, I don't agree with any of these. I have never been in heaven. Me'olam lo hayiti bashamayim, and I don't know if this is the Eschalt of Geula or not. What is clear to me, Rav Zevin said, the Medina is a tshuwa gedola, it's a great salvation, l'am Yisrael. And in the founding of the State of Israel, there were great miracles. On Yom HaAtzmaut, he used to say hallel without a bracha. But he used to go to the minyan at Mosada Rav Kook, where they used to say hallel with a bracha. Someone once asked him about this, and he said to them that I go there despite the fact that they say it with a bracha. And he explains, he said that in my area, where he lived, I think he lived in Geula, he said they don't say hallel at all, and therefore I'd rather daven in a place where they say it with a bracha than in a place where they don't say it at all. I said this, I think, outside last time, that Rav Zevin's position is almost identical to Rav Soloveitchik's position, although Rav Soloveitchik, according to most reports, didn't say it with a bracha either, although some claim that if he davened with a minyan that said it without a bracha, he too would say it without a bracha. But here you have Rav Zevin denying that anyone can know it's the Eschalt of the Geula. It could be Rav Soloveitchik is sharper, actually, now that I think of it. Rav Soloveitchik is strong that it's not the Eschalt of the Geula. At least I think he is. He seems to express himself this way, that not that he's agnostic on it, but that we shouldn't even be using this sort of terminology. This is not something for... It seems that Rav Zevin... it could be that Rav Soloveitchik is also agnostic, but the way he expresses it, he's very negative. He's down on people who see the State of Israel as Eschalt of the Geula. He said very harsh words about this, what he called this stupidity of speaking as if we're at the beginning of the redemption. Rav Zevin never spoke that way and never had such harsh language. He just said he's agnostic. He does not know. Those who are interested in this tradition of agnosticism, I read today Rav Lichtenstein's piece about Hurricane Sandy. We have all these geniuses out there, all these prophets in their own mind that can come out and tell the world why there was a hurricane. Jews spoke Lashon Hara, Jews did this, Jews did that. Everyone has a reason. You have to read Rav Lichtenstein, where you get the classic answer, of course, that, am I God? How are we supposed to know these things? And that was always Rav Soloveitchik's response to matters, beginning with the Holocaust. Email me, I'll send you the link. Yeshiva Haaretz Zion has begun in the last few months, publishing English traces of Sichot he gives. I assume these were originally given in Hebrew, but there you find it. And these are not, three paragraph things. These are long discussions, which probably in the Beit Midrash took a half hour, 45 minutes, and they're summarizing it. I say it originally took place in Hebrew because that's what I assume. Although I wonder sometimes, he quotes Voltaire and some other writers in this, and my experience has always been that the Israelis, they don't get much in terms of Western culture, and I know sometimes in the past the joke has been, I assume it's a joke, maybe it's real, that he quotes some of these people like Voltaire, and they try to find out, who is this Rabbi Voltaire, so I don't know, but I'll send you the link. Jokingly, Rav Zevin also said that we have to say Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut and also Tachnun. Hallel on the state and Tachnun on the government. But I think that's just a joke because from what I've seen, he never said Tachnun. And the other joke was that he did like Ben-Gurion. That's a joke for Tzvi Pesach Frank. I said no Hallel and no Tachnun. He said Hallel. He wrote that we are actually in another place, he writes, that we are obligated to say Hallel and have a Seuda, because it's a festive time, but not with a bracha. He hung a flag on his house, an Israeli flag, on Yom HaTzmaot. I mention all this to show you that it's not a question about his Zionism. And we're going to see very soon why this is so important, because I'm going to point to you in just a few minutes. Art Scroll has done some bad things, not so many bad things, a few bad things, but one of the worst things, and something which they will never be able to get repentance for, unless it's altered in a public way, relates to his Zionism. We will see that in a minute. He did not have a firm bringing. But again, let me read you something he wrote about... by the way, Baruch, I don't know if you were here. I answered a question of yours before. This is how Rav Zevin explained in an interview in Panim El Panim why he's against, the new practices that have developed about Yom HaTzmaut. There's even something Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria came out with called the Tikkun LeYom HaTzmaut with special prayers, all sorts of things that drove Rav Soloveitchik crazy. He writes as follows. I'll read it in Hebrew and then translate it. We do not have this ability to create new religious customs. He says all the tekasim, these practices, these things you do, I don't know a good word for tekas, all these the tekases that we do today, the various practices, and the more formal word for it, someone's going to give me a better word for tekas, he says they are melachutiyim, they're artificial, they're ceremonial, and nothing else. Yes, ceremonies, that's it. Meguchachim mamash, they're laughable. He says it's a joke. Parodiyah shel HaShulchan Aruch, it's a parody of the Shulchan Aruch. Ze yoter garua mimasachat Purim. That is, we know that they have this thing, Masachat Purim, it's always a big joke. He says this is worse. Ki masachat zo nichtav atekef. That this he says, Masachat Purim was written as a joke. Everyone knows it's a joke. But Tikkun Yom HaTzmaut, they would do a Haftorah. They would do all sorts of things. He says, this was done for a real reason. But it's a joke. We don't make special, we don't create a new system. Hallel, that's not new practices. Hallel, we have a tradition. And this goes back as far as we can go, that we have traditions that if a city was saved, where a great thing happened, you could say halal. So, and the Rabbanut Rashid said, but you don't say it with a bracha, because that's more problematic. Some said you say it with a bracha. But to create new special prayers, and new ways of acting, and like I said, some people did a haftorah, and all sorts of things that he said, that's artificial, we don't do that. Rav Soloveitchik had the exact same perspective. Despite his tzionus, his Zionism, Rav Zevin felt that yeshiva students must not be drafted. We usually associate Zionism with a belief in drafting of yeshiva students. And I just saw today that they are now saying, I don't know why they're waiting, but they're saying beginning summer of 2013, yeshiva students will be drafting. I'm not a betting man, although I did bet on Obama. I didn't vote for him, but I bet on him. I won a dinner to the nicest kosher restaurant in the area by my friend. If I was a bet, if you're a betting man, you can always assume, or pretty much assume, that not only do the Zionist rabbis support that everyone should go to the army, but I'm telling you, I would not bet on the yeshiva students being drafted this coming summer. Odds are, between now and then, there'll be some coalition, and they'll come up with some deal. But I don't know. But we usually think of Zionist types supporting national service of some sort, or the army. Rav Zevin thought otherwise. No, the government is on these small purchases, as small things, and government is a mochela, not to mention the fact it's a gift. So you don't have to pay tax on a gift of that amount. Gifts are only a certain number. Only if it's, I think, $13,000 a year do you have to pay a gift tax. So if my friend were to give me $12,000, I wouldn't have to pay a tax. Yes, the minimum. He publishes an article on this. By the way, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who we had classes on, was also opposed to drafting yeshiva students. But he felt that as soon as they finished the yeshiva, they must go into the army. And for them, he was very opposed for people saying draft dodging or draft avoidance. He said it's deferral. And the truth is that Merkaz, it is a deferral. They'll defer for 4 or 5 years, and then they'll go into the Army, and all the rabbanim coming out of it, Army. Okay, you say it's not a gift, it's winnings, like if I was on The Price is Right. Okay, I think the government is not concerned with the $25 dinner at the most. If I go to Passaic, believe me, the restaurants there, we're not talking about Prime Grill or something where it's a lot of money. But Rav Zevin writes this article called Al Tigu Bimshichai. Don't touch my anointed ones. And he explains, of course, that the yeshiva students are, you know, are vital to the Jewish people. Again, we're talking about in the 70s, or maybe it was earlier, actually. It might be in the late 60s. He's publishing an essay, I think it was the 70s, about not drafting yeshivas. That's different than now, when the numbers, so you're talking huge numbers, tens of thousands. But in any event, that was his position. Now, why is it so important to note this? Well, because there's an essay that appeared anonymously. It was published anonymously in 1948, an open letter. And after Rav Zevin's death, it appeared in a booklet called Talmud Torah and Army Service, and it's attributed to Rav Zevin, this letter in the Hebrew University card catalog, and it's become an accepted fact that Rav Zevin wrote this essay. It was even translated into English and published in the journal Tradition in 1985. This is how they begin the essay. Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin was universally acknowledged to be one of the great Talmudic and halachic scholars. The ideas expressed in this article are now well known in Israeli circles. What is most significant is that they were written by someone of Rav Zevin's stature, and that when he published it as a monograph in 1948, it was under the pseudonym Echad HaRabbanim, one of the rabbis. So let me read you what Rav Zevin supposedly says, just one paragraph, because it is a strong affirmation that yeshiva students must fight in the Army. There is no such thing as an exemption. It's a Mohammed mitzvah, and a Mohammed mitzvah, everyone goes out to fight. And let me just read you the first paragraph. What is the source for exempting yeshiva students and Torah scholars from an obligatory war fought to defend Israel from those who come to destroy her? God forbid. How can you pass it off as if it were halacha or da Torah that yeshiva students need not register or serve? Have we not learned that when it comes to saving a life, not many lives, just one, these things were done by the leaders of Israel and by the scholars in order to teach the halakha to the nation? Was any distinction made whether or not it is time of learning Torah that is to be lost? If this is the case in the saving of one life, how much more so in the saving of tens of thousands of Jews? And then he goes on for the next few pages, explaining how this idea that yeshiva students are not obligated in the mitzvah, pikuach nefesh, they're not obligated to help defend the Jewish people in a mechametz mitzvah, is a complete distortion of traditional Jewish thought on matters of life and death. So, very nice sentiments for those of us in the Zionist community. Incredibly significant if written by a man of Rav Zevin's stature, a man, as we said, not just universally acknowledged, but really one of the greatest figures of his time. And it would be great if he wrote it, I'll say. But as far as I know, and this is what I was going to say last time, I'll say what I was going to say, and then I'm going to say what we subsequently found out, thanks to David. As far as I know, this is not the case. Rav Zevin did not write this. There's no evidence of this. His grandson, so I saw online, who is very honest about Rav Zevin's Zionism, about his legacy, I saw online that he denies that Rav Zevin wrote it and said everything Rav Zevin wrote, he wrote in his own name. He never used a pseudonym. So the way I was going to end last semester when I got to this is, let us see some evidence that Rav Zevin wrote this article. No one seems to know about it until the 1980s. I thank David Eisen very much. David Eisen from Beit Shemesh, who usually listens to the classes live, he followed up on this. And I have to say that the matter, it still is a bit mysterious, but let me tell you what he found out. And I will be publishing this eventually on the Sfarim blog, but let me just summarize to you what he found out by calling Rav Nachum Zevin, who was the closest of the grandchildren to Rav Zevin. And he says to me that, this is David Eisen, he had a lengthy talk with Rav Zevin, although we never spoke before. I was very pleased with his accessibility and willingness to speak to a complete stranger. I was most impressed by his honesty and candor, which he seems to have inherited from his grandfather. And by the way, I once had to send someone else to this Rav Zevin to get letters from Rabbi Weinberg to Rav Zevin, and they also came back speaking very highly about him. He wished to clarify, this is Eisen reporting, that neither he nor anyone else in his family denies that his grandfather wrote the 1948 pamphlet with Sheilat HaGiyus Shel Bnei Yeshivot. So contrary to what I saw online, he reports that Nachum Zevin reports that no one in the family denies that he wrote it. He simply said that the family had no indication that he wrote it. In other words, they're agnostic. They are not denying it, but on the other hand, they have no evidence that he wrote it. But again, I even what I said before, I didn't deny he wrote it. I simply said there is absolutely no evidence he wrote it. So we'll see that maybe there is a little evidence, but he says that they don't say he wrote it. But here's the facts he presents. One, of all the grandchildren, he, that is Rav Nachum Zevin, was closest with Rav Zevin and went through all of his grandfather's writings and had a major role in publishing his posthumous works. He says that he meticulously went through his grandfather's study and never found a copy or any draft of this pamphlet among the many manuscripts he found in his house. So that would lead you to think that he didn't write it. Two, the attribution of this pamphlet to his grandfather was only made years after his grandfather's death in 1978. The first time he heard this attribution was during the early 1980s from Rav Menachem HaKohen, when he was a Labor Party member of Knesset. Just today, when I was going over my notes, I emailed his son Aviad Cohen, who told me he's going to ask his father and get to the bottom of this. As such, no one in his family had the opportunity to discuss it with his grandfather. He says that if anyone would have known about his grandfather's authorship, it would have been his father, that is Nachum Zevin's father. Yet Rav Nachum Zevin's father also told him that he first heard about the attribution only after his grandfather had passed away. So how is Menachem Cohen supposed to know that Rav Zevin wrote this booklet in 1948, when for 30 years after the booklet, no one in Rav Zevin's family, including his son, ever heard anything about this? What's going on here? Three, Rav Nachum Zevin refers to the article Al Tigu B'Mshichayo that was published in 1973 on the heels of the Mafdal's decision to support drafting yeshiva students. And Rav Nachum Zevin says that this article created a veritable earthquake in the Dati Lumi camp. And Rav Zevin was attacked in the pages of HaTzofer for weeks and months. Yet despite the voluminous criticism, no one mentioned the pamphlet, which would have been a good proof to show that Rav Zevin had radically changed his views. That means that no one knew this. David then says that perhaps you could say there's a difference. In 1948, the situation was much more dire than after the Yom Kippur War, but Rav Nachum Zevin agrees with this distinction, but he also notes that to think that no one would have raised this point in all the attacks on Rav Zevin from the Mizrahi, that he changed his mind. He goes on. Beyond all of the above points, Rav Nachum said what makes the attribution puzzling is the fact that his grandfather was never reserved about his beliefs. And that makes no sense to him that he would have published the pamphlet anonymously. After all, His highly positive views on the State of Israel and the annual celebrations of Yom HaTzimut were well known. He told me that he was so closely affixed to the Mizrahi Party that he, this is from Nachum Zevin, remembers up to the 1960s that Rav Zevin would affix his signatures along with Rav Meshulam Roth and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook on endorsements prior to elections to vote for the Mafdal Party. Mafdal is Mizrahi and Hapoel Mizrahi. He also mentioned the parenthetical phrase Ashreinu Shezachinu Lekach in Hamoedim V'Halacha. We'll get to that in a minute. That is all the evidence, not to conclude that, in other words, there is no evidence that Rav Zevin ever could have written this. However, that said, he said that one cannot avoid comparing the writing style of the pamphlet with Rav Zevin's unique and eclectic writing style. Moreover, he said, the substance and analysis of the Torah reasoning in the pamphlet is indeed very similar to his grandfather's Torah writings. He acknowledged Lo Ra'inu Eino Ra'ya. He says that the family has not found any proof, but the writing style leads him, and not just him. David spoke to the other grandson named Yaakov Zevin, who also would not say he wrote it, but he said, if you look at it, you can see who wrote it. So the other grandson is more affirmative, although he too has no evidence. I'll just leave it that I don't know what to say about it then. All the evidence, or I should say there is no evidence he wrote it, other than the style seems to be Rezevin, but no other evidence. What I can say is that anytime this is quoted, it should properly now be referred to as attributed to Rav Zevin, or of questionable attribution, because there really is no evidence. And, I mean, truthfully, if you're asking me, I don't have the sense of Rav Zevin that his grandson has, but all the points he gave in opposition to say that the style reads like Rav Zevin, if I find out anything else from Rav Nachum Cohen, I'll pass it on. I think Nachum Cohen, all he's going to say is that's what he heard. If he says that he heard it from Rav Zevin himself, then I think we can put the matter to rest. But who knows? Okay, let's now talk about some of his written works, because his literary achievements are really incredible, and there's a lot that has yet to appear. Not only from manuscript, but many articles. He had a weekly column in Hatzofer, the Mizrahi newspaper. And a number of these essays of his were collected in three volumes called Sofri Musfarim. But there are many, many articles, including many dealing with topical issues, issues of the day, which have not been collected. I know about these because when I was researching my book for Rabbi Weinberg, I went through many of the old Hatzofes, and there were articles by Rav Zevin in almost every single issue. Some of them were collected, some of the big ones. We spoke about his... we didn't speak about yet his article on snow and some other things. I'm not sure if we spoke about that yet, but many of the things originally did appear were collected, but many did not. His responsa as well. He wrote responsa. Hasn't yet been published. His most classic work, however, reprinted many times, is Hamoedim B'Halacha. If you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, it says that this work inaugurated a new Hebrew style in writing of halachic literature, and that is true. Today you have loads and loads of books that focus on the holidays. Yet when this book appeared in 1944, it was completely new. There was no other book that examined the holidays like Rav Zevin did. I encourage everyone, it's now available in English, before the various Chagim, to read it. It really is a wonderful work. It has many imitators, but it was the first of its kind. It was also the first halachic work, really, that I know of at least, that has footnotes. That it's written in an academic style fashion. This is now standard. In fact, some of these works, you have one line of text and the whole page is footnote. I mean, you can't hardly read a text like that. And now they do this with the Ritva and the Rashva. They really went overboard, if anyone knows the Ritva to Yevamos. But this is now standard, text and footnote. That's not a traditional Jewish way of writing. That's an academic way of writing. It's just another example of how the Torah world has been influenced by the academic approach, and we're going to see the Talmudic Encyclopedia soon. But that is Rav Zevin. What's original in it is the method of organization, the style. In terms of content, I wouldn't say there's really much originality. That is, it's not Rav Zevin's ideas. What he does is he gives you a beautiful presentation of various aspects of the festivals. He has a nice chapter on Kitnios and on everything you want. But he's not really giving new ideas, interpretations, but the organization is wonderful. And as I said, it's a beautiful work. It's now quite standard. Art Scroll knew how important this work was, how nicely it would sell, and just really, though, I don't think that they translated it because of that reason. I think they translated it because it is the greatest work in modern times dealing with the festivals. And Art Scroll, in addition to all of its Hebrew, all of its classical translations of classic Hebrew texts, Talmud and Midrash, I mentioned that when they finished the Yerushalmi, and I don't know what, in Midrash Rabbah, what are they going to do? I guess Tosefta, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, they still have a number of years to go. But they also wanted to translate more, I wouldn't say popular work, but a work that you don't have to learn, but you can read. And they translated Hamoedim B'Halacha. I have to say that, I don't know what Shas Lavan is, but you have to tell me what Shas Lavan is. Yisrael asks, was I surprised that Art Scroll would print the book of a Mizrahi type? Under normal circumstances, no, but the book is just Torah. It's not Zionism. Except for one part. And it's a classic work. This work, Hamoedim B'Halacha, has been reprinted in more times since its publication than any other halachic work in modern times. I think the second most popular would be Shmirah Shabbos Kelechasa. By now, Shmirah Shabbos might have surpassed this. But as of about 10 years ago, this was the most popular. It had gone through like 29 different printings I read somewhere. By today, Shmirah Shabbos Kelechasa might be the most popular halachic work printed in modern times. But then this would make Hamoedim B'Halacha second. So it's a very significant work. What I want to say about Art Scroll is, Baruch says Rav Kook's writings. No, Rav Kook's writings have not been printed more. Rav Kook's halachic writings consist of his responsa, which have only been printed a few times, and his Shabbat Haaretz, which is on Shemitah. And that's only been printed a few times. So they do not come close. I might be overlooking another modern halachic work, but I don't think so. I'm not talking about the Kiddush Shulchan Aruch or anything. I'm talking about an original halachic work written in modern times. I can't think of anything else. And in terms of English, I can't think of anything that's been reprinted so many times. We have books in English. Ribiyat's book on Malachot have been reprinted a number of times. No, I don't know of any other work. We have books on Pesach, on things like that, on Arba Minim, but you can't compare how many times they've been reprinted. Let me tell you now about something Art Scroll did. And I'm not an opponent of Art Scroll. A few years back, I said that I really never use the Art Scroll Gemara because I just use Steinsaltz. I try to have a Seder every Shabbos, and I have a Seder with Steinsaltz. I like Steinsaltz. I like everything about it. But in the last few years, whenever I have a problem in the Gemara, I go to Shul because my Shul, like every Shul, basically has the Art Scroll. And it is such an impressive work. Steinsaltz is more impressive only because it was done by one person, but just in terms of overall quality. And also, and I like Steinsaltz, I like the realia. I like, if they're discussing like a jug, I want to see what the jug looks like. Now you have the competition, by the way, both to Steinsaltz and Art Scroll, the Koren. I said that I don't know how they're going to keep up with Daf Yomi. I see that Masech HaShavuos came out, or at least the first half, but I still can't see unless... How are they going to be able to put out a new Masechta every couple of months? I can't imagine. You tell me that they're going to have Erevin soon, and then they're going to have the rest of them. If that's the case, then they've been working on this thing for 20-some years. So I can't imagine that that they're going to have any more of this Daf Yomi cycle unless they've been holding it. extraordinarily impressed with the achievement of art score. Obviously, there's issues, there's problems. I mentioned it already. Not only is the English volume, but the Hebrew art scroll, and I have a good friend, or I shouldn't say a good friend, but a colleague who works on the Hebrew art scroll, it remains a censored text. This crowning achievement of Talmudic interpretation in the art scroll still does not include the stuff that was taken out. And Koran is largely based on Steinsaltz. So I'm not an anti-art scroll. I don't care for the history volumes, but granted, if they want to write history as hagiography, that's fine. That's their response. That's their book. They can do what they want with it. I don't have a problem with it. It's not for me. However, to tamper, to alter someone else's text, not your own, someone else's, is just simply unforgivable. And that's why I say that, one of the worst, I would say probably the worst thing Art Scroll has ever done, and until this day has not been rectified, the crime still stands, and what they did, as we'll see, was stupid. It didn't even reflect the mainstream Haredi viewpoint they're supposed to represent, and when the crime was discovered, it became a mini-controversy, and I'll give you the details in a minute. In Hamoedim B'Halacha, in the edition I have, which is now the standard edition, in Purim through Elul, page 442, Rav Zevin is discussing Vitzomos, the fast days, and the Chorban. Because that's not a holiday, but he discusses the Jewish calendar. And the issue is that you're supposed to do Kriya. And when you see the destroyed Yerushalayim, you're supposed to do the Kriya on the Makom HaMikdash. We've spoken in the past why today the custom seems to be not to do Kriya, although when I was in Yeshiva 20 years ago, we were told you're supposed to do it. That's why they told us to go there on Shabbos, so you wouldn't have to do it. I speak about that in one of my lectures, how even then I thought that this is something's wrong with this. We shouldn't be trying to get out of things. But he discusses the various halachot, that if you see one city in its korban, you don't have to then tear for another city. And then he quotes the Beis Yosef, and the Bach, and the Taz, etc., that what's the definition of Churbanan Sha'ar Yehuda, the destruction of Ar Yehuda, doesn't mean that it's desolate, after Hurricane Sandy or anything like that. It means Sha'akum Moshli Malayim. It means if non-Jews are in control, that's what it means. That so if you'd go and you'd pass through Jericho in the days that it was ruled by the non-Jews, maybe today also, because they gave it back, you'd have to do Kriya. And then this is what Rav Zevin says. This is not some, what I'm going to read you now, is not super Zionism, it's simple halachic reasoning. Mistaver. He says, it appears likely, makes sense. She'im shichruran sha'are Yehuda mishilton nachrim v'hakamat medinat Yisrael, ashrina shizachinu l'chach, batel din hakriya al'otan harim. He says, it makes sense that now, that the cities in Judea, he's not referring to the West Bank, because this was written before, he's just referring to the other areas, that these cities, Ar Yehuda, have now been liberated from rulership of the non-Jews, and we've seen the establishment of the State of Israel. How fortunate are we to have merited this? That there no longer is a din of Kriya if you see one of these cities. Why he even has to say Mistaver? Well, what's the question? I think, because someone might say, we haven't totally rebuilt. We're not in Messianic days. We're still in the destruction, or secularists are ruling them. You can come up with all sorts of reasons, but he says, no, Jews are ruling them. Look, King Ahav was a wicked king, and we had plenty of kings in the south who are wicked, but it was never thought to be Golus then. We dealt with this, I forget who we dealt with it, but Sir Rav Zevin's saying, not something, as I said, crazy Zionistic here, just that now that Jews rule it, because we have had the creation of the State of Israel, how fortunate are we that this has happened, there's no more Kriya. The reason I say that this reflects mainstream Haredi view, because other than Satmar, typical Haredi is also happy that Israel was created, and is also happy that Israel rules over these areas. They might not be Zionist, they might be non-Zionist, but if it's a choice between the Arabs ruling it, or the English, or someone else, and Israel, even the non-Orthodox Israel ruling over it, They are happy that Israel rules it. They ask the typical Haredi, would you wish that there never was a state of Israel and you're still living in Poland? And they'll say no, just that we have to make the state of Israel better, or Torah state, or whatever they'll say. So he doesn't say anything crazy. And yet, if you look at the Art Scroll translation, the three words, Ashreinu Shezachinu Lachach, were deleted, were taken out, as if this is such a terrible thing that you can't even mention that we're happy that there is now a state. So basically, that what they're saying is they're reflecting a position that really we're not happy that there's a state. There's a state, so we have to deal with it. We'll deal with it, but it would be better if there wasn't a state. We're not happy there's a state. It would be happier if there wasn't one. I mean, it took a few years, but the censorship was noticed, and it created a mini cause celeb, and it was mentioned in an article in Tradition, again, the journal Tradition. This goes back to an era. If you go back to the 80s, Tradition was the only Orthodox journal. Now we have a number of Orthodox journals, and if you ask me, the most interesting of all the journals is one produced by a group of amateurs, a group of guys in Flatbush, not professional academics or rabbis. They produced this journal, Chakira. I saw a new issue, just came out a couple days ago. I am in my next Svarim blog post, which I had to delay it because I was in Muncie over Shabbos, Gar in residence. When you see the post, maybe you'll be able to figure out why I couldn't publish it when I was in Muncie, but if not, I'll explain it next week. Hopefully it should be out by then. I deal with the last issue of Chakira. Without question, the journal Chakira is the most interesting of all the journals. It's not afraid to take risks. It's cutting edge. It's a little bit iconoclastic. It publishes all sorts of things from all sorts of people. It knows how to keep things interesting. And Tradition became boring. I don't know if I even mentioned this. Tradition censored me. They wouldn't let me publish what I wanted to publish. Thank God we now have blogs and have all the other things, so I said I won't ever write for them again. But leaving aside my personal issue with them, it just is not very interesting. Sholem Karmi, as the editor now, has made it a little more interesting, because under Emanuel Feldman, it really collapsed, and you could fall asleep reading that issue, those issues. But at the time, in the 80s, Tradition was all there was. And this was pointed out, and Tradition and Art Scroll was attacked, and they responded, Rabbi Sherman and Zlotowitz. Okay. Baruch says, the blogs, you say Chakira, but you know, they're not, you might have assumed they wouldn't be independent, because these are people living in communities that are Haredi light. You know, these are not people living out in the university, and you gotta be sure that they got negative feedback publishing Nussan Slifkin, you know, was Rashi a corporealist, publishing Josefa Orr. I mean, but these are risky pieces and interesting pieces they publish, and apparently they don't care about the disputes. It's also available free on the internet after the next issue comes out. They know how to market. They know how to get good letters to the editor. They don't believe in censoring for ideological purposes, at least so what I've heard. If they think you're ideologically too far to the left, they won't publish it. But the issues they're very good. And if you look at the very first issue, they sent it out, or the second issue, actually. They sent out the first issue to various people for comments. And the second issue, the great Yaakov Ellman writes into them a little bit contemptuously that, what do you think you're doing? Reinventing the wheel? And yet, if I'm not mistaken, Yaakov Ellman had an essay. Was it the last issue or the year before? Issue before. So Yaakov Ellman came to realize that if you want to write for the Orthodox world, if you want to write for the academic world, obviously you don't go to Chakira. But if you want to write for the Orthodox world, that's where the excitement is in the journals. Okay, so in 1986, Rabbi Sherman and Zlotowitz replied. And they claim that the people involved in translating this work, Hamodi Mahacha, were close to Rav Zevin, and they understood his attitudes. And that as time went on, his excitement over the state lessened. And therefore, based on this, they censored, they took that passage out of the text. By the way, it was only in the year 2000, around 2000, that Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, in speaking to Rav Nachum Zevin, who's a shtickle Chabadnik, I've never met him, but he's been described to me as like, not exactly Chabad, but sort of, I guess like Rav Zevin, perhaps. He did, the book had been out in English translations at least 15 years. In the, around the year 2000, it was actually a little after 2000, because I remember when I first met Rabbi, okay, it's not important, but the book had been out a number of years. He had never heard of this censorship till Rabbi Chaim Rappaport told him about it. And he said that no one in the family authorized this censorship. They knew they were doing a translation, but no one was asked and no one authorized. And in his conversation with David Eisen, let me get the page again. He said to him, where is it here? He says, he also mentioned the parenthetical phrase, with respect to the establishment of the State of Israel, etc., and that it was removed from the English translation. That was used. This was used to claim that he no longer held positive feelings towards the Medina, but Rav Nachum utterly rejected this assertion as wholly false, and that he never changed his views in this regard. What? It's not like Rav Zevin became Satmar. I mean, he was disappointed with some of the governments that came in, and so here you have the assertion by Rav Nachum Zevin, who he writes the prefaces to all of Rav Zevin's Hebrew works that are republished. He is, I guess you could say, the literary executor. He is the spiritual inheritor of Rav Zevin's position. He was the closest of the grandsons, and he is the authority to in terms of spiritual authority behind all the publications of his writings. So this was done without any permission, and Art Scroll knows it was done without any permission, and I know the family rejects it. Now, a letter to the editor was published after the letter of Sherman and Zlotowicz. This is in by a Terry Novetsky from TNEC. I don't know who he is, but and he goes over the things I'm just saying. They don't tell you in the introduction that they took liberties with the text. This is a text, let's not forget. Bluntly put, the translators misrepresented a text written by recognized Gadol B'Yisrael by removing specific language they found objectionable and did so without alerting the English reading audience of their act. This is nothing less than intellectual dishonesty, and I would suggest Kanevas Das as well. Secondly, then he goes on that he points out that there have been over 30 editions of Hamoedim B'Halacha published by Rav Zevin. Rav Zevin never once saw fit to change this. They saw fit to change it. Let me read you the last paragraph. Finally, we are told that Rav Zevin's disappointments with the realities of Medina Yisrael caused him, in the view of his confidants, to change his halachic ruling regarding Kriya upon seeing the hills of Judea. That's actually not the issue. The issue is the Ashrenish Zechino Kach. Oddly enough, this freshly excavated position of Rav Zevin's has nothing to do with the actual deletion the translators perpetrated. That's right. In Sherman and Horowitz's essay, in response, they talk about how, well, maybe he felt that today you don't need to do Kriya. You do need to do Kriya. The Art Scroll version still suggests that Kriya may not be applicable today. What is eliminated is a related reference to the State of Israel as an expression of joy at what Rav Zevin perceived to be a zechut, a divinely granted privilege at its establishment. And he goes on and on and on. And, you know, like I said, I say it's one of the worst things they've done, because if they decide they don't want to put the prayer for the State of Israel in their sitter, that's fine, it's their work, they can do what they want. But to tamper with someone else's work, that's it's completely unacceptable, and it's really beyond the pale. And I don't know how often they did this. I can tell you that they, by the way, when it came to the prayer for the State of Israel, when the RCA paid them, they did put it in. But they also censored it when it came to Lieberman. If you read my booklet on Lieberman, you know that Rav Zevin refers to Lieberman as Rav Shaul Lieberman. He gives him the title rabbi. and when this work was translated into English by Art Scroll, the references were altered to read, quote, S. period Lieberman. So, in two of the volumes, in one of the volumes, is it one of the volumes, or is it volume three or volume two? I forget. You can see my booklet. It was a different translator, and he didn't know that you're supposed to censor Lieberman. So he refers to him as Rav Lieberman, which is a direct translation of what Rav Zevin wrote. But in the volumes that they knew to translate, I have here in my notes here, volume one, they censored it. Volume three, they didn't. I think in volume two, doesn't mention him. So again, it's the same thing. That they thought it was acceptable, even though Lieberman was one of Rav Zevin's closest friends. In fact, Lieberman used to say that I have to always go to Rav Zevin, because if Rav Zevin comes to me, he's a chassid. We're done. I'm ready. You know, we finished talking. It's an hour. I want to get back to learning. But Rav Zevin, as a Hasidic guy, a big raconteur, he'll keep talking. So Lieberman says that I always go to Rav Zevin, and therefore when I'm done, I get up and I can leave. They chose to take this out. So I mean, what can I tell you? It's an old story with them, but this is really the worst example of this. Okay, let me ask for some questions, and then we go on. Larry points out who Terry Novetsky is. Well, thank you very much. Baruch says they put it in only in a special RCA edition of the Siddur. They did put it only in a special RCA, but the RCA edition, they've sold more of those than the regular Siddur, because every modern Orthodox shul today gets it. What that shows you is that it wasn't so much, you know, it wasn't really ideology, it was just money. They didn't put it in the first time. They could have put it in the back of the Siddur. You know how much stuff is in the back of their Siddur? Piyutim, things like Gottfried Avraham, things that very few people, if anyone, says in almost every shul you go to, yet they put it in. They could have put the prayer for the soldiers, the prayer for the state in the back. After all, lots of shuls say it, but no, they claim that ideologically this is not our way, but really it wasn't ideology. They didn't want the Siddur to be put in Chayrim. And then when it turns out they can make a lot of money and it's almost it's in a different Siddur, then they put it in. Had they put it in the first time, the RCA wouldn't have produced their own Siddur. The RCA didn't need a Siddur. The only reason they needed the Siddur was because they needed to, those special prayers. This whole thing could have been solved. Was there correspondence between Rav Zevin and Lieberman? Well, there is correspondence. I found in the archives, they even published how Rav Zevin referred to him, but they lived near each other. Lieberman would go back to Jerusalem in the summer, so they were friends for decades, the closest of friends. Bill says, read Art Scroll on Birkas HaChama. They write an intro to Rav Leich's work. They have to change the intro in the new one published last year. It's esoteric. Yeah, but there they change it to with Rav Leich's permission. If Rabbi Leich gives them permission, that's not a problem. It might show them as small-minded, but it's not criminal. That's their outlook. But we know what their outlook is. But to take... You know, they wanted Rav Zevin, but they didn't really want Rav Zevin. They wanted Rav Zevin if they could, Rav Zevin verbessert. They wanted Rav Zevin improved. And it's just intellectually dishonest. And Novetsky, let me get my paper here, in the end, the last paragraph really sums it up, that what they're doing is that they deny people the ability to see that... one authority's legitimate conclusions may not be compatible with another's. I mean, what's going on here? The idea that, the readers of Art Scroll aren't learned enough to know that, or sophisticated enough to know that just because Rav Zevin was happy at the state's founding, that doesn't mean that everyone was? Not to mention the fact, show me an Aguda Gadol who's not happy with the state's founding. All the great Aguda Gadolim, I assume even except for maybe Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Zalman Meltzer, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the whole gamut of them would have been happy at the state's founding. So I don't know what the issue is there. But that's the story. As I said, this was a big controversy in the mid-1980s. It's totally forgotten today. And the book remains in print by Art Scroll, and it has not yet been corrected, so the crime still stands. And what can you do? They wrote an intro different than what he wrote, Bill. I do not believe that Art Scroll would have written an introduction without to Blech's book without Blech's permission. Oh, I see what you're saying. They have a preface. Oh, they wrote... Oh, no, not that they altered his thing. They wrote things in the introduction different than what he wrote. Okay. So he might be annoyed with that. I don't know. Okay, it's 10 o'clock. We still have to get to Rav Zevin's works. The Talmudic Encyclopedia, Ishim B'Shitot. Wait till you see some of the stuff in Ishim B'Shitot. Rav Zevin is the source for some of the most important and fascinating stories about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and I'll tell you some of them, as well as some other things. What you say so much for the concept of Das Torah, that is the concept of Das Torah. The concept of Das Torah is precisely because Rav Zevin didn't hold of the Das Torah, therefore his opinion is of no use and of no value. And it is to be rejected, and if you can get away with covering it up so no one knows about it, that's even better. But that is exactly Das Torah. But the reason why I've said so many times that Das Torah is so phony is because if one of the Aguda Gedolim, if Rav Elyashiv, in the last year of his life, decided, had a change of heart, and said, this year we should say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut, because I realize that, the state of Israel really is doing a wonderful thing, giving all this millions and millions of dollars that Yeshiva Bachrim could sit and learn, and whatever reason he gave, they would not start saying Hallel. They just would remove him from the canon of Gedolim. He then would no longer be their Gadol. I mean, he's quite old, so they'd say he's senile, or they'd say something like that. But Das Torah, they don't really mean to follow the viewpoint of their Gadol. They have a viewpoint. And whatever Gadol follows it, they can crown him as Das Torah. But if that Gadol then has a different perspective, changes his mind, he gets bumped, and someone else takes his place. The Gadol, the Das Torah makes the Gadol. The Gadol doesn't make the Das Torah. They have very limited room to maneuver. And don't think it's only with the Lithuanian Gedolim. I went to Williamsburg when I met with Goldhaber. There was a couple other guys there, Hasidim, including one from the Satmar Rav's family. They read the post. They wanted to talk, Shmu. So I asked him a question. Because often we think that Hasidish Rebbe's are like gods, and they can say whatever they want. So the Belzer Rebbe was in the news about something. So I said, what if the Belzer Rebbe tomorrow said that that you have to say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut? This would apply to, I think, any of the Rebbe's. They said, well, he can never say that. Because they don't give him much room to maneuver. So I said, well, let's say he did say it. Well, and the answer is, well, then most people would find a new Rebbe. So even the Hasidic Rebbe's only have limited room to maneuver. So I was told by these Satmar Hasidim. Let's see. Okay, so we'll end here. Let's just take some questions. My book will not be out for Hanukkah. The book is done. The book on censorship, which is the reason that we have to postpone some of these, is finished. I have to read over each chapter one more time, I was told. I have all the pictures. It then goes to the editor, the one who has to put it into English style and just make sure everything, all the cross references read. Then it's published. We're hoping 2013, but it will not be out for Hanukkah, but I am going to start putting stuff on the Sfarim blog that I could not, for various reasons, including I see Rodney Falk is with us. I don't know if this is if you were with us last semester. I think you were with us before then. He sent me something unbelievable about Rav Henkin, who we dealt with, Rav Henkin, and I will be putting that, not the next post. I am going to have a couple posts that follow shortly in succession to each other. But a lot of this censorship stuff that I really just didn't have a place for, a room, or they didn't fit in, I'm going to be putting that on the blog, so you'll get a lot of that stuff. But the real good stuff will be in the book, and I thank Rodney for sending me what you will see. What Rodney sent me is just, well, we can talk about it, but it's almost as bad as what the Art Scroll just did. But please don't give it away, Rodney. I want to surprise everyone. Baruch said, when did the Williamsburg meeting occur? The Williamsburg meeting was in July. Rav Goldhaber from Eretz Yisrael. Yes, he's written Svarim and many, many articles. Shlomo, academic presses don't censor. I've been censored by tradition. And then, don't you know the story about the Svarim blog? Remember the Svarim blog for about a year was, it was the tradition Svarim blog? What happened was that they wanted to censor my posts. And Dan Rabinowitz, he wouldn't let them censor it because they agreed before they took over that they would have no input in content. And they wanted to bring people to their website. So they wanted the Svarim blog, which is thousands and thousands of people read it. They didn't like my posts. They thought what I said wasn't fitting, suitable for the RCA, I guess. Although I know plenty of RCA rabbis read them and write to me, but whatever. So they wanted to put a censor. They wanted to do two things. They wanted a censor of Shapiro's posts, and they wanted someone to censor the comments. Because they don't like. So the answer was no, and I can't say many people go to their website, and the Svarim blog has just grown and grown. What can you do? No, I'm not a member of the RCA or any rabbinic body. I'm going to write about this one day because we're getting to, I think the Svarim blog now, I have a list, has been quoted in numerous academic articles, and it's the new world now where blogs, obviously some blogs are not good, some are high quality, but blogs now are an essential part of scholarship, and I want to speak about what I think the significance of the Svarim blog. I want to give credit to Dan Rabinowitz for, at his own expense and time, created this, and in that I'll talk about, maybe if he lets me, he doesn't really want me to spread it, so don't spread it, the ill-fated encounter between the RCA and the Svarim blog, but I think it says something, and it shows why tradition is not Chakira. What was I saying so crazy when I was writing? What I wrote that they wanted to, that they did censor. I wrote about Ratz Yehuda Cook, his view of the Chazon Ish. I later published it in the Eida Journal, in Ma'orot, or the Eida Journal, I forget what it was called then. My article on Saxon Kamenetsky, I published what they wanted to censor, at least, and the world didn't collapse, but what can I tell you? Yes, I will be speaking, God willing, Motzei Shabbos in Highland Park. Okay, what is the worst instance of censorship in our times? I can't say, but Baruch Hashem, I mean, Mirza Hashem, the book will come out. You'll see loads and loads of examples, and believe it or not, you know how I start? I start the book, just like I started the book on Rabbi Weinberg with I want to catch people's attention. I start the book on censorship to preface with what the Satmar did, that Satmar paper did with Hillary Clinton, that iconic photograph of watching the Bin Laden killing. They removed her. Now, that made the news. That made international news. It was all over the place. Most of these things, these sorts of censorship, aren't picked up anywhere. So that's how I start it. The topic on Saturday night is, Are We One? I think we call it Orthodox Separatism from Rav Shimshon or Paul Hirsch to today. And, there you go. Thank you, Mel. If anyone's in the area, please come introduce yourself. It should be a very nice evening. They always do a wonderful job. I've been there once before, but I know other people have been to other events, and they do a great thing there in Edison, Highland Park, that whole area. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. We will pick up again next Monday night. Thank you again for joining us this semester. Good night, everyone.